Hello. I would like to start session number 336, Stay at Home Moms on the Record. My name is Camille Agard, and I will be moderating this panel. And I would like to first introduce our panelists. So, introducing myself, I graduated from the U of U, married Rob Agard, who is out here supporting me in that denim shirt with the salt and pepper hair, and I had a five-year career in San Jose as an account executive at a PR agency, and at the conclusion of that, I packed up my drawer and started a new career raising five children. Then we have Courtney Kendrick, who isn't with us yet. She is the mother of one son and wife of one man. She grew up in Provo and still calls it home. She wasn't vegetarian, then she wasn't, and now she isn't for sure until the next time she has a diet crisis. She blogs at cjanerun.com and housewives simultaneously. She loves having too much time on her hands. Then my good friend Linda Wilkins worked for 5 years as a technical writer before going home full-time 9 years ago to parent eight children, four of which are stepchildren from her husband Bill McGee's previous marriage, and Bill is supporting her right there in the baseball cap next to the salt and pepper man. Seven of the eight children, ages 24 to 4, currently live at home. Linda was a leader in the student activist feminist movement at BYU in the mid-90s. Then we have Rebecca Buchert. She has a master's degree in philosophy and four children, ages 2 through 10. Since having children, she has worked part-time, off and on, in various capacities, helping to run a home business as the program coordinator for the University of Hawaii's Center for Health Disparities Research, as a legal secretary and an adjunct philosophy instructor at Utah State University. Currently, she is not working and pursues writing and quilting as time permits. And then lastly, we have Erica Munson, Harvard graduate, who jumped into the mother business after graduation and never looked back, mother of five, ages 10 to 25. We ask that you would please silence your phones. This is a 90-minute session. Each of us will take about 10 minutes. And at the conclusion of our remarks, we'll open it up for a question and answer period. I attended a session last year that found me in this position today. It was, I've forgotten the title of it, but it was exploring Julie Beck's talk, and there are a number of panelists, and I was in the back listening and felt that there was a lack of a voice from the stay-at-home mom population, and I expressed my concern, and look where it got me, moderating this panel. So I appreciate Sunstone listening to that concern and inviting us to do this. What I want to do today in my talk is address what motivated me to become a stay-at-home mom, tell a little bit about my upbringing, what shaped my major life choices that led me to the decision to become a stay-at-home mother, and then I'll share with you my rather tumultuous journey through motherhood over the past decade. Okay, what motivated me to become a stay-at-home mom? A little about my upbringing. I was essentially raised as an only child, two much older brothers who were gone, grown and gone. When I was eight, my family moved to Salt Lake City. And though my parents were inactive at the time, I was befriended by the bishop's family, and they essentially raised me in the church for the ensuing 10 years. The happiness and vitality in their home was tangible to me, and other similar families' homes had that same feeling, and it was extremely appealing to me. And I decided at a pretty young age that I really wanted that. I wanted a home and family like that, filled with happy children and devoted, faithful parents. So then my progression from college to mission to career to family. My parents' decision in which university to send me to was probably informed by both finances and perhaps a rather confining view of what my future role as an LDS woman would be. After completing the application process, I was thrilled when a couple of prestigious East Coast schools showed some interest in me. But in 1988, the economy took a sudden downturn, and my dad thought the full ride at the U of U was much more appealing than the tens of thousands of dollars that the East Coast schools would require. And frankly, I think both my parents had the very pragmatic view that a state school was enough for a daughter who planned to become a stay-at-home mother. So off to the University of Utah I went. I had a mandate from my father that I was to finish school before I got married if I were to afford his financial support. This was not a problem for me whatsoever. I was absolutely committed to getting educated, and I loved the experience of getting liberalized by legends such as J.D. Williams. My parents also afforded me the wonderful privilege of studying abroad in London and Europe for my senior year. Immediately upon return from Europe and graduating from college, the bishop called me into his office, and he served me with mission papers. I was completely blindsided by this. I had no intention of serving a mission, but he and my father felt it would be an excellent opportunity of growth for me. So I prayed about it, and I decided to accept the call. It was a great, difficult experience. I learned I could do hard things with fortitude. Upon returning to age 23, I was now interested in getting married and having a career. So in choosing a spouse, I knew that I wanted the economic freedom to eventually be able to stay at home. And this definitely informed my choice of partners. I met my husband, Rob, and we married and moved out to San Jose, California to each embark on our new careers. I worked for 5 years, as I said, as a PR executive. And like I said, I cleaned out my desk 2 days before my first child was born. And then I moved into the phase that I call my motherhood abyss. And the first few months of my child's life were some of the darkest days that I had ever encountered. Breastfeeding was an around-the-clock disaster. Nothing seemed natural at all. I was exhausted and miserable. I never wished I could go back to work, but I was completely surprised by how hard motherhood was. Almost a year later, we were informed that our daughter was globally developmentally delayed. Over the next few years, we discovered that our daughter has a severe genetic disorder called Angelman syndrome. Jessica is profoundly mentally impaired, almost nonverbal, and at age 11 is wearing both a bra and a diaper. Incontinent now for 11 years, I have scrubbed pounds and pounds of poop and gallons of urine out of carpets, walls, clothing, and furniture. I started wearing this apron every day to address the mess. Shortly after I started wearing it, I looked into the mirror and I burst into tears. "What has happened to me?" I asked. At the onset of my motherhood, I had planned on having one of those Nordic-looking families, a large portrait of which would be prominently displayed above the fireplace, all of them bright and precocious. But when does life go as planned? Rob and I have instead embarked on a very different journey. Mothering this child has forced me to squarely face unsavory characteristics about myself, weaknesses in my faith, a fickle relationship with God, and a selfish relationship with my church and my community. For 10 years, I decided my life wasn't fair and that I was a victim. I made God wrong for giving me this trial. I made other women wrong, anyone who had that happy family life I wanted, wrong. I determined that they were all Stepford wives, and I hated them for it. I threw things at the TV during general conference. Everyone at church bugged me. I made the church wrong for suggesting I should be nurturing. What a narrow, confining, rigid formula, I thought. I told myself that I wasn't naturally nurturing, which then, of course, absolved me from being nurturing. This gave me permission to be at times gruff and rude to all five of my children, particularly my special needs daughter. I made my husband wrong for being kind and nurturing to Jessica, accusing him of permissiveness. Despite the brutal hours he keeps at work, I made him wrong for not helping me enough and just knew that he was sexist. All of this was not my opinion. It was the truth. I was thoroughly and completely miserable, and it was no fault of mine. Clearly, it was the fault of my retro church, my sexist culture, my overly idealistic community, my selfish husband, my impossible child, and even my judgmental God. I was an utter and complete victim. Finally, about a year and a half ago, it was pointed out to me that I was getting a huge payoff for what I was doing. I just looked out and saw the friend who pointed it out to me. I didn't know he was going to be here. I want to cry that you're standing there. He has made such a difference in my life. The payoff was I got to be right. I got to be right that my life wasn't fair. I got to be right that my child was absurdly difficult. I got to be right that the church expected too much of me, presenting me with all these whispery-voiced women who pretended to be happy raising their children. So I got to be right. But it was pointed out to me there was an enormous cost for this payoff. The costs were my life. I had traded my life, all vitality and happiness and self-expression and the love of my family, just so I could be right that my life sucked. Finally, I decided that these costs were too high. I started to look into what possibility I could create for myself and my life that would really move and inspire me. And I realized that what truly moved, touched, and inspired me, what I wanted most in the world, was the possibility of creating love and life with my husband and children each day. But to create this possibility, I would have to give something up. I would have to give up, like sacrifice, like lay on the altar, this grip I had on being right, that my life sucks, that I'm not nurturing, and that everyone expects too much of me, especially God. So nothing has changed, and everything has changed. The circumstances of my life haven't changed, but everything has. That family I had always dreamed of is right standing before me every morning with all their sparkling eyes and energy and enthusiasm. What has changed is how my life occurs to me. And I wish I'd stood over here so you could see my apron. This apron can occur to me as a symbol of servitude. But what if I saw this apron as an emblem of my intense love for my family? What if I saw it as an emblem of my power as a teacher? Every day I can create the possibility of teaching five other human beings about the basic principle of work and responsibility, which will ripple out to create beauty in the world. What if I saw this apron as an emblem of sacrifice, which I believe is synonymous with personal progression? I am intensely interested in personal progression. I think human beings crave it. What if I saw this apron as an emblem of influence? Isn't real power and influence not about elevating self, but about lifting others? Some people call this high regard for raising children as the motherhood rhetoric. I create it for myself very differently. What I create, what I declare, is that I am a mother, a shaper of human souls, and I am a partner with my husband. It is our high privilege and intent to lead the five human beings we have created together to become loving, contributing, hardworking, and most importantly, self-sacrificing individuals. Yes, self-sacrificing rather than self-fulfilling. Because Rob and I are not interested in raising up children bent on self-fulfillment. We believe in paradox, And there is a very old paradox that says it is only in losing oneself that one finds oneself. I am deeply touched by the possibility of passing on a legacy, a chain of daughters and a son who give up their lives only to find true life, followed by more daughters and more sons who give up their lives only to find true life in an endless chain of sacrifice, charity, and love. Thank you. Okay. Panelist Courtney Kendrick is stuck in traffic and will be here as soon as she can. So we will hear from Linda.
I mean that honestly. If anyone has got one, I can use one.
Thank you.
Thank you, Camille, for inviting me to do this.
It's clean.
It doesn't look clean.
I really am grateful that there's a place at Sunstone for women who choose the stay-at-home lifestyle that we have chosen, and I'm really grateful to have a voice here and be able to speak about my experience. I feel like I'm an unlikely homemaker. My own mother worked when I was young, and I remember asking my dad at a young age if it would be okay if my husband stayed at home with the kids because I wanted to work. His response, by the way, was, good luck finding that guy. I remember as a teen thinking that all the nice moms were the ones who were disrespected. My friends' moms, who always had baked treats waiting for them when they got home, were somehow earning the disdain of their families for being selfless. I did not want to be that woman. I developed some strong feminist sentiments while studying at BYU and helped organize a protest for Clarence Thomas's visit to campus that landed us on CNN. I included that because my husband thought I needed to add it for street cred. When we got married, I had been working as a technical writer for 3 years, and I had no intentions of quitting. My husband, Bill, had 4 children from his previous marriage, the oldest of which never had visits with her mother, so she lived with us full time. She was old enough to fend for herself until Bill and I got home from work each day, and the other 3, ages 9, 6, and 5, were with us about half the time, mostly weeknights, evenings, and weekends. Then we had Harper, and I spent 2 glorious weeks following the delivery, staying at home with her. I never put that kid down. She slept with us, and I did everything with one hand so I could hold her constantly. After going back to work, I longed to be spending those 9 hours, 5 days a week with her, and for 3 years, I felt guilty each morning when I dropped my crying daughter off at daycare. I romanticized the stay-at-home life, imagining us playing together, helping her pick up her toys, going on outings, playdates, hanging with my stay-at-home mom friends, reading books. If I didn't have to work, I would have time to take a class or two, learn a new skill, finish up neglected household projects. Then the Chicago-based company I was working for shut down their technical branch in Sandy and left us all without jobs. That same week, Bill got a significant raise at his job at Cisco Systems, and my 3-month pregnant belly began to show. I had always had misgivings about becoming the primary housekeeper in my own home, but that decision to go home at that point in my life seemed like a no-brainer. I had no idea what I was in for. Instead of complaining about going to daycare every day, my daughter began asking to go back because she missed her friends and her playmates. That surprised me. She was bored and getting into things, and I was busier than I thought possible, and thinking when the new baby arrived, I would not be able to cope. We had 3 more kids following Harper for a total of 8. 6 of whom live at home currently. I stink at running a household. My neighbors who are stay-at-home moms look like professionals by comparison. They really are. They run a tight ship. They have a chore routine that results in less whining and more cleaning than I think is possible at my house. I am surrounded by these women. I don't know how some of their kids who achieve so much in my community in music, sports, and academics could do it without their moms there, making them practice, helping them get their homework done, and driving them to lessons every week. If anyone is just not cut out to be a stay-at-home parent, it would probably be me. I'm disorganized, I'm indecisive. Throwing anything away is a big problem for me. I sometimes spend hours doing things that should take minutes while neglecting tasks that really need my attention. My strategy is to take the kids on outings where we don't have to contend with messes at my house. I love it. My kids are my favorite people. My life when I was working was consistently affirming but boring. Life in the trenches with kids is always unexpected. The stakes are high, the good times are better than anything I have ever experienced, and the bad times are equally intense. Parenting, for me, is nothing short of magical. I feel so blessed, so fortunate, to have the privilege of rearing these wonderful people. Getting to spend their early days and years with them is a beautiful thing. Stay-at-home parenting also has its ugly, lonely side, filled with thoughts of failure, depression, and endless, thankless, menial tasks. Some days, I just want someone to high-five me for going the extra mile and washing and folding that sixth load of laundry. But then, I think, what kind of accomplishment is that? These tasks could be done by anyone, and much of what I do daily falls into the someone's gotta do it category. In the working world, even if nobody says, "Good job on that report," someone will almost always say, "I got that report you sent." I feel alone at times, I think, because it feels like without someone witnessing all my thankless work, my tree is falling in the woods and not making a sound. Some of us who spend many hours in the kitchen each day have problems with food. Many of us resent our families for taking us for granted, leaving messes, or neglecting chores. We feel demoralized. I fall into that category often. I have griped a lot over the years about being a domestic servant to my ungrateful family. But it's our moral imperative as parents to ensure our children's needs are met. Needs that include nurturing, loving, permanent adults to attach to. How we choose to do that is a very personal but public decision. And I think that's where I notice tension in the women, especially Mormon women, between the ones who choose to work and the ones who choose to stay at home who have younger children. We should get good information when we make these choices, and then we should determine, as we notice, Camille has to feel good about those choices. One psychological study that I read showed that small children have fewer attachment issues and fewer social problems when their primary caregiver was a parent. The interesting thing that I found in that study was that they could find no difference in the benefit if the parent was the father or the mother. And I think that's one of the tragedies, I think, of emphasizing so strongly the division between the roles of men and women in the church, is that we tend to cut the fathers out of parenting their own children. And rather than feeling that it's unfair that I get dumped with this load, I feel a lot of times that the men in the church are denied the kind of relationships and the wonderful experiences that I get as a parent spending that time with my children. I volunteer for the Guardian Ad Litem in Provo. I've been doing it for 9 years, and I help represent the needs of children who have been abused or neglected by their parents. I see firsthand the suffering that children endure when their parents are not there for them. These children live in poverty, but the children that live in my neighborhood, some of them also suffer from abuse and neglect. They might not end up in the court system, as the kids that I work with do, but they will end up in specialty schools or in wilderness programs. And I, as parents, it's a hard decision, but we need to decide that it's not beneath us to cater to our children, or to put, or it's not appropriate for us to put our social needs before their need for nurturing. I agree with church leaders when they implore us to love, nurture, and provide for our children, that our family should be our greatest priority, and that no success can compensate for failure in the home. I've found that I have much less influence with my children after about age 11, and that's a very short time to help them learn what they will need to lead a healthy life. I find in the scriptures, too, that Jesus shows a profound respect for children in the New Testament, but I find nothing in the scriptures that tells me all women should stay at home and raise children. I want my working sisters, single sisters, childless and older sisters to know that I respect their life decisions. In an ideal world, we would all have better options and easier choices. There would be lots of job sharing, part-time benefits, flexible work hours, and on-site daycare. If you have young children and your full-time job helps you pay for your second Mercedes, I am going to choose to assume that you made the very best decision you could for your family. I have a great collection of books. I want to show you some of them. I get them at DI. This one's called If You Must Work. The Power in Being a Woman. How to Feel Great About Being a Mother. Motherhood, a Partnership with God. This is one of my favorites. Self-Esteem for the Latter-day Saint Woman. The Joys of Homemaking. A Woman's Divine Destiny. And The Joy of Being a Woman. I find these entertaining, but I do look in these books and find, well, you can imagine what's in here. A lot of talk about trying to convince ourselves as mothers how to boost our sagging self-image. And, you know, these are the old ones, and so they're kind of silly, but my husband's trying to tell me. There is, he's reminding me about the lipstick. In one of these books that I read last night, there was a directive on how to feel better about yourself. Paint your lipstick in a smile, and it will help you to eventually feel like a smile. It's entertaining, but it's also sobering to think that there's a market for these kinds of books. And we have our modern versions, as you know, at Deseret Book. But I think women in the church find it almost impossible to meet the expectations, obey the directives, and avoid making choices that would invoke the chastisement we sometimes hear from the pulpit. I would assert that we need to get each other's backs. I want to feel understood and supported by my working mother sisters, and I want them to feel that wholeheartedly from me. And I also want to for us to encourage our fathers that the complementary role to motherhood is not necessarily priesthood or godhood, it's fatherhood. And parenting as a team is a partnership with God. And that's my experience, and that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Well, my name is Courtney Kendrick, and I'm sorry I'm late. I'm so used to being a stay-at-home mom. When you have to leave your house, it gets kind of tricky. I'm the beginner on this panel. I've only been a stay-at-home mom for about 15 months. However, what might set me apart here is that I left my job to become a stay-at-home wife. So I was a stay-at-home wife for a couple of years before we had a baby. That came about because I was approaching 30 years old, which of course we know in this culture is ancient. And we had been trying to conceive for about 4 years, and it just was not happening. And every year I would start a new school year. I was working at an elementary school thinking, you know, maybe this would be my last year and then I could quit and stay at home, because that was always my goal. And when I was going to college, everything that I did was kind of tainted by the fact that I just wanted to stay at home. So I kept going and going and going, and finally, when I was about to turn 30 years old, I thought, what if my husband and I are just not meant to have children? What if that's just not a blessing that I would get in this life? Does that mean I'll never be able to stay at home? And that took me to some introspection and some prayer and some meditation, and finally I decided, no, I want to stay at home. That's the career that I've always wanted, and so I was going to do it. So I told my husband, I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to be a stay-at-home wife. And I didn't know anybody else who had ever done that, and it perhaps seemed kind of lazy, but I knew it was the right thing to do. And my husband at the time was a professional actor, and so our paychecks were very spotty. I had the only paycheck that was certain every month, and so when I quit my job, it was clearly up to him to get more work. And the month that I quit my job, we were incredibly blessed. He probably made the most and got the most jobs that month than in any other month in his career. So we knew it was probably a right decision. The great thing about being a stay-at-home wife was that I kept myself completely busy. And now that I have a child at home, I think about what I do when I put him to bed for a nap or at night. Those are the things that I did as a stay-at-home wife. Prepared, got meals ready, or cleaned the bathroom, or whatever. I just didn't have to manage a little child at the same time. So actually, it was quite wonderful. And my husband and I were able to establish routines together in our household. So we were, we had time to establish what we were going to be like as a family. And we had time to do that. And for instance, we decided that the laundry was going to be a separate entity. I was going to do my laundry and the household laundry, like rags or whatever, and he was going to do his own. And that's just been established, and that's the way we do it. But there was, and I'm really lucky for that, may I just say. But that time period gave us a lot of organizational opportunities, I guess I should say. And then when we finally were able to conceive, we had a lot of things already established. We already were one income family, and that made a lot of things easier. We didn't have to have the shock of suddenly becoming, you know, two incomes to one income when we had the baby. And then also for me, I had established a lifestyle so that I wasn't quitting my job and having the baby at the same time. It wasn't a concurrent experience. So I didn't have that shock of realizing that not only am I a mother, but now I'm home full time. So that worked out really, really well in our instance, in our case. We felt that that was the best decision for our family. And now I'm very supportive of women who want to do that. I think that women who want to stay at home and hope to do that, I give them the encouragement to do that as soon as possible, not wait for some wait to get pregnant or to adopt or whatever it may be to stay at home. I think that also if a woman wants to get a career and use that career to better her experiences at home, that's even more wonderful. now I consider being able to stay at home a luxury, and my husband is one who would rather stay at home. He's a husband that would have me go to work, but I do find that during the day I am full of thoughts of gratitude to be able to stay at home. But I do realize that staying at home is what it is. My sister-in-law said to me the other day that when she had her second baby, her first son would nap from, her baby would nap from, let's say, 10 to 12, and then her son would nap from 12 to 2, and then her baby would go down from 2 to 4, and she was saying, when do I go out and, you know, run errands or go to lunch or whatever? And she said, and then all of a sudden it hit me, oh, stay at home means that I stay at home. And I think it's been the same experience with me. I just have decided that the closer I am to home, the better I feel, the more my soul feels at peace. And so I gave up my car and decided that if we can't get there by a stroller, then we don't go. I had my sister's three oldest children for 6 months, and I have decided that the worst part about being a mother is getting kids into car seats. I appreciate them. I know that they save lives, but holy moly, is that the worst? Thank you. So, yeah, I just decided I'm going to give that part up. So we walk, and if it's not a walking distance, we wait for Dad to get home and we all go together. And that has worked for our family too. But like I say, I'm a beginner and I don't know what the future holds for me. But the other thing that I really love about staying at home is that I'm also at home with my thoughts. And being able to have a quiet lifestyle where there's not a lot of interaction and where I am completely in control of my choices allow me to be able to think a lot. And that's another thing that I think is a luxury about staying at home. I'm always able to think. And I'm really grateful for that, because I don't know of any other career that allows someone to be completely in control that way. And maybe there is, but for me, that's what I find so beautiful about being a stay-at-home mom, is that the choices are mine. And just to give an example, mealtime wasn't working for us. I felt a lot of pressure, especially for dinner. About 4 o'clock, I always felt like, oh man, the pressure to have dinner was on. And it always made me really, really grumpy. So I just decided, you know what, I'm in control here. We're not doing meals anymore. And we pretty much did away with established meals, and we just eat when we want. That has also worked for us. And like I say, I don't know how that's going to play out in the future, but that's one of those beautiful things that I find about staying at home is that outside opinions don't matter, because it's my own little world that I get to create. And so that's what I have found to be wonderful about staying at home. And I'm sure I could probably read a couple of your books. Maybe I'll borrow some. Maybe I represent the youth and the ignorance that comes with the beginnings of stay at home. But that's me. Thank you.
Staying at home without talking about working as well. I realized that I've been thinking the last few weeks about my experience and what I would have to share, is that I generally make one of two assumptions about working. I either see working as the promised land, the chance to go and do what I want to do, or some kind of prison sentence that I have to tie to somebody else's schedule, agenda, and priorities. My perspective on being a stay-at-home mom has evolved over the years with my assumptions. When my first child was born, nothing could entice me to leave her to go to work. I couldn't bear the thought of leaving her in someone else's care, and I had a strong sense of responsibility, that raising her was the responsibility of me and my spouse and not to be shifted to somebody else. After my second child was born, I went through a period of depression and resentment. I still fiercely loved my children, but in my unhappiness, I sometimes envied my husband for getting to pursue what he wants. I reminded myself that I had other options, that I chose to stay home, but in some ways didn't really feel like it really was an option to go to work. Though I was afraid that if I went to work, I would be putting my children in a less optimal situation. I didn't have any qualms about going to school. I saw education as purely positive, a way for self-development and preparation. I questioned my motivations for going back to school. Did I not feel like I was enough without an advanced degree? Would I use the degrees? And I eventually had an epiphany one day that I realized at a certain point, you get to the end of the degree road, and the way that you continue progressing is through practice. You have a job. And that kind of shifted my perspective, I guess, on work, and that it would be okay at some point for me to work. And I guess that reveals my operating assumptions at that time, that I thought it was okay to go to school or work if it was for self-development, but not for a career or to be a wage earner. And I equated going to school or work with getting to do what I wanted. And also, schooling I sort of saw as the key to my liberation. I eventually did go back to school, and to avoid taking on more student debt, my husband and I juggled our schedules for our degree programs and part-time work. So I worked part-time for the next 5 years, and the semester I started back to school was one of the happiest semesters of my life. Though working part-time was a good balance for me, it also helped to shift my views about working. Most of the time, working didn't really mean to get to do the things that I wanted to or that I loved. A lot of people who work full-time also wish for time to do the things that they love or feel the need for some other creative outlet. I began to see staying home as a luxury, not to have to spend my time and energy on someone else's priorities. When my last child was born, I quit working to be home full-time. As much as I'd like to think of myself as irreplaceable with my job, I knew that the work that I was doing could get done by somebody else, and ultimately where I was not replaceable was at home with my children. In reality, work, whether in the workforce or in the home, is not so binary between the extremes of getting to do what you love or a prison sentence. It is not either or, but both and. It is getting to pursue what I want. I do want to stay home with my kids. But there is also the frustration of being tied to somebody else's needs, whether it's a boss or my children. Though I'm happier now to be home now than I ever have been, there are struggles. Some of the struggles for me personally have been adjusting to intangible results, crisis of identity, and sacrifices of ambition. When you work at a job, you have tangible results to point to, even if it's just years of experience racking up on a resume. Your efforts stack up with achievements. As a stay-at-home mom, it is difficult to recognize or pinpoint your achievements, and you certainly won't get recognition from anyone else, unless you have a really great spouse like I do. Also, what can you really claim as your work? Do you take credit for your children's accomplishments or contributions? What measurements can you apply to assess how you're doing? A wise lady once told me when I was a very new mother that you can't look to your children for reassurance or validation because they're more likely to criticize you than anything else. And that's true in my experience, both as a girl in my parents' house and now as a mother to my own children. The angle and the force of the criticism may change from whining to complaints to acute barbs, but appreciation is not always forthcoming. It was a difficult transition for me to go from being a full-time student and working to being a stay-at-home mom. You might have done more easier transition. I landed in an identity crisis. The markers I had come to define myself through, the things I studied, the grades I got, were no longer there. As a society, personal identity is strongly tied to career. We introduce ourselves often by tagging our vocation, whether we're engineers or into graphic design or et cetera. And like you said, the Deseret Books version of our motherhood, the Jane Clausen Johnson book right now, I Am a Mother, she urges us to own our roles as a mother and to say proudly, I am a mother, which I appreciate her motivation, but I also think it's a little bit of a double standard because we don't introduce, our men don't introduce themselves as by saying, I'm a father. A lot of times the way they explain about who they are and what they do is tied to their work. And that might be tied to class or culture or whatever, but I think that that is often the case. I recently went to a high school reunion and was a little wistful as I confronted what some of my classmates had accomplished in the time since I had passed since graduation. I almost wished I'd been a boy so that my ambitions could have uncomplicated priority. That what I can achieve in a chosen career is not necessarily dependent on how much time I dedicate to it. It is strongly correlated. There's variety in capacity, and maybe some people can still achieve a lot even though time allotment is small. Or maybe someone can be inspired to make some major contribution even though they come late to the game, say after their children have been raised. Whether or not I still can have a successful career, choosing to stay home means sacrificing some other agendas. I put some stuff on the back burner to be with my kids. Another assumption that's sometimes made is that it has to be all or nothing during the child rearing years. Either you stay home or you work. And I don't think it has to be all or nothing. The balance of needs shift and things change. We constantly readjust hoping to strike the right balance. And I anticipate that I will work again. And right now I try to set aside time for my quote-unquote work and put emphasis on developing my interests with the aim to escalate that development as I can. Whatever the balance is now, it won't stay this way forever. I know you noticed in the panel that discussed about the panel also mentioned some of the stereotypes. So I've been thinking also about what are some of the stereotypes that I've confronted as about being a stay-at-home mom. And I've been called a soccer mom, and I do drive a minivan. And even though the labels are a little bit uncomfortable, I like going to my son's soccer games. And the van is actually kind of a comfortable vehicle for our family. those don't bother me so much because I like what I'm doing. And more painful comments have implied that I'm not contributing to society. When my first daughter was born, a former employer called up and asked if I would go to work for her full time when I didn't, and she was kind of frustrated and said that, she complimented me and said, you're so bright, you need to contribute. But the implication is then that motherhood is not a contribution. And I reject that motherhood is not a contribution, and this might be another assumption that we maybe should examine. I've become happier being a stay-at-home mom if my assumptions have shifted. I no longer assume that I have to stay home. I no longer assume that going to work is getting to do what you want. I've learned that I have more than my interests or grades or accomplishments. I've come to believe that I can accomplish more with my family, including my children at my back, than I could on my own. I've learned that sacrifice can be an investment, and that investment is already paying off.
Well, if Courtney is the beginner here, I'm the grizzled veteran. And I want to take you back to the mists of history in 1972. I was an eighth grader growing up in an LDS family in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And even for a 13-year-old, the feminism that was in the air trickled down to me and my girlfriends. We considered ourselves very liberated. We wore flannel shirts and corduroys. We eschewed makeup. And we felt sorry for girls with big breasts. The first edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves, which is a kind of feminist body Bible, was in the school library. Many of our mothers were reinventing themselves, leaving marriages that didn't work anymore now that the rules had changed, getting out in the workforce, or pursuing graduate degrees. My own mother was reading Kate Millett and Gloria Steinem. She was regularly meeting with other Mormon women in a group that would eventually lead to the publication of Exponent 2. So maybe I represent the first generation for whom feminism was a given. I didn't have to be converted or have my consciousness raised. That women should control their destiny was a no-brainer. But teenagers have a gift for perceiving irony, and no revolution is entirely free from it. There was something in the movement that bothered me. Despite all the talk about a woman's right to choose everything, some choices, it seemed, were more equal than others. The work of a mother had been downgraded and was often ridiculed and belittled. If at cocktail parties the answer to "what do you do?" was "I'm a housewife," you might get a condescending lecture on finding something more meaningful to fill your days. And so, even though the term stay-at-home mom hadn't been invented yet, I felt strongly enough to write an editorial about this persecuted group for an 8th grade writing assignment. I encouraged my classmates whose moms didn't work not to be ashamed of them. It was a perfectly valid choice. I wrote with confidence because even though my mother was learning and exploring new ways for women to be in the world and the church, her primary role was taking care of us, and she was extremely happy doing it. I knew that deep down. Maybe I also knew that this would be my path. I got a fabulous education and met the man of my dreams at the tender age of 19, and shock of shocks for the Harvard community, I was married at age 20. In 1980, nobody in Cambridge except the Mormons were getting married. My husband and I were quite the curiosity among our college friends. I finished up my bachelor degree in art history and supported us with minimum wage, secretarial, museum, and gallery jobs until Shipley finished graduate school. But I was just biding my time until the work I really wanted to do, shall we say, presented itself. I knew I wanted 5 kids, and I wanted to start as soon as possible. So I started procreating in the 80s and kept right on through 1998. My youngest is now 10. My oldest has graduated from college and started his professional life. Up front, I will say that I am lucky, very, very lucky that I could afford to do this. We all know that too many of us who want to stay home can't. But the rhythms of life at home with kids has suited me very well. I'm a meditative kind of person who revels in the poetry of everyday life. I can find meaning where no meaning may exist. The isolation from other adults, one of the great challenges of being at home, I dodged through my personality type. I'm something of a loner. It was okay with me if I was the only mom in a sea of nannies at the playground. It took some getting used to when I realized that for at least the first and second play date with my toddler, the other mom wanted to stick around and I had to be sociable. Sometimes I think of myself as a stay-at-home mom, extreme edition. I've put all of my eggs, no pun intended, into this basket of raising children. I didn't make partner at a law firm and then give it all up. I didn't get my PhD bit by bit. Until very recently, I didn't even spend a lot of time volunteering, and I was very careful about how I executed my church callings. That inner 8th grader, ever on the lookout for hypocrisy, has noticed that you can neglect your children through good works and laudable causes, even though you may not get a paycheck for it. I wrote down this quote the other day from a woman who, there was a discussion on NPR about the work-family balance, and this is the quote. "We have to maintain an identity separate from our children because they grow up, and then where are we?" So here, almost 40 years after the dawn of feminism, the assumption that if you don't have a career outside the home and you have no identity, that assumption still persists in places. Any book with the word "mommy" in the title is not going to be supportive for stay-at-home moms. And speaking of book titles, I find the 10-year nap particularly annoying. Of course, I have no quarrel with those who have made other choices, and I still have questions, some of which are, who can really speak for mothers at home? Because the moment a woman writes a book and goes on the talk show circuit, she's no longer the primary caregiver. Could it be irresponsible to specialize in home and family so deeply that you're out of the job market for decades and would have a hard time supporting your family if you had to? And along the lines of Courtney giving up her car, which I find incredibly laudable, what are the material things worth giving up so that you can stay at home? I want to read you a quote and shamelessly plug a book by a friend of mine. The author's Daphne DeMarnock, and it's called Maternal Desire. And it's not about stay at home versus not stay at home, which is refreshing. It's about the meaning of motherhood. As mothers, we should give ourselves the room, the dignity to discover what we think and what we want. Each of us must think through the issues for herself, so that the life we live in personal creation, so that life we live is a personal creation rather than a resigned to reality. It's hard to hold on to the threads of our lives while we're mothers, but at the same time, the actual practice of mothering carries within it an extraordinary thrust toward happiness. It is a happiness that we must find the words to articulate and that we owe to ourselves the freedom to explore. I would argue that the 25 years I've spent in this endeavor has been some kind of sacrifice, some kind of separating myself from my wants and needs. It has, in fact, helped me grow up and figure out who I really am. It's transformed me in a way that I don't think any other experience could. In a crazy way, I didn't do this for my children. I did it for me. Thanks.
Okay, well, that concludes the panelist section, so now we have the fun part, opening it up for question and answer. And please, anyone who has questions, come to the microphone.
As a veteran state, is this working? It doesn't sound like it.
It's on.
As a veteran stay-at-home dad, how come there aren't any stay-at-home dads on your panel?
I thought of that last night. And I asked her, who could we call at the last minute? And we could have called Mark England.
No, next year when they have the Sunstone on Man, then maybe we'll do that. What I'm curious to know, as far as I can tell, none of you, all of you chose more or less to be stay-at-home mothers. And if my statistics are correct, one-third of women will find themselves in a situation where they are single or divorced with or without children sometime in their lives, where they have to earn a living, not by choice, but they have to by necessity. And none of you have been put into that situation yet, and hopefully you won't. But how do you psychologically work through or prepare or tell other people how to prepare for a very high probability that you may, when you're 22, think, okay, I'm going to get married, I'm going to be a stay-at-home mom, I'm going to do this, and life is going to go just as you predicted to, when one-third of women, one, won't get married and will need to get a job to support themselves, or will be divorced and need to support themselves. How do you find that balance so that you can prepare for that, but then still pursue, you know, raising your children, which is what you value the most?
I'm sort of confronting that right now, in that the economy has gone bad, and it would really probably help us a lot if I went to work. But I have no resume, and so that's why I wrote down one of the questions. So I'm sort of looking at myself and, gee, is that selfish and irresponsible of me all these years to assume that I would be supported? And I don't really have an answer.
Well, I certainly do have a resume. I have the contrast of having worked in an office setting as an executive and in running my home. And I have acquired more skill now in running my home that I assert I could craft the resume to make you look like a CEO. Now I'm a wordsmith, you know, I'm from the public relations realm, but I don't know if that's unrealistic. I think I could talk my way into a pretty good paying job and just out of my confidence of the skills I have acquired, I don't know, I haven't put it to the test.
That's what I was going to say. My aunt was recently put in that position, a really difficult situation at home, and I think we have to think in terms of transferable skills. Although the difficulty is that when you have a resume, you have somebody who can vouch for those skills. When you're in your home, you don't always have that, but the skills are still there. So, but I do think it does present a challenge.
And one more comment from me. I am so committed to those years of education leading up to the decision to get married and stay home. And I have four daughters, and heaven help them if they choose anything other than the most arduous education. And they may very well choose that, and that will be a challenge for me, but I have a real commitment to that. I don't really frankly know if you have that Harvard degree, if that helps you get a job 30 years later. I would think it would. I think with confidence and the ability to show that you're a thinker and a doer and a contributor, that you can do many jobs very well.
I pass it.
I think that when you ask that question, how do you prepare for that possibility? I don't ever think about going back to work, but I think a lot about what if I were doing this job really, really well, I could probably save a lot of money. And in saving a lot of money, that would probably prepare me for the possibility of perhaps being widowed. So that's how I prepare for it, not necessarily to get back to work, but to save my money now, be better at cutting coupons. I don't do any of that stuff, but if I was doing it really well, I could probably save a lot of money, and that's kind of the road that I'm on right now. So,
please, come on.
Just a couple of questions.
We're recording.
Questions that relate to the evolution of technology, your technology and culture. One of your questions caught my attention: who speaks for the mother who stays at home as a vocation? And I know at least two of you are bloggers, and so I'd be interested sort of in your comments on whether evolving communications technology may be a resolution to that sort of conundrum. And secondly, I'd be interested in each of your perspectives about this strange moment in history that we live in, again because of technology and its correspondent evolution in culture, where the vocational means of support is constituted as this atomic unit in terms of a skill set and this sort of singular dedication of time outside of the family sphere. And I wonder, as Latter-day Saints, with an eternal perspective, what do we imagine is going to happen in the future when we're not in an industrial, specialized labor situation any longer? Or perhaps when we evolve our culture past that and it's no longer necessary for a father or a mother or somebody who's got parental responsibilities to leave home and go dedicate themselves to the spinning of the economic wheels for a while. Be interested in your comments on that.
Well, I'll start. My answer about questions regarding the next life are, I don't know.
Sorry, that was this life.
Oh, this life.
Later in history.
Sorry. But I misunderstood. But you're saying then that we'll make this transition into a completely different model in this life.
Well, I'm just saying that this backdrop that we're wrestling with, the economic and cultural reality that we're wrestling with that poses this challenge, of course, is a very recent historical development. And it's not human reality writ broadly. It's not the human experience, but broadly, it's kind of a circumstance of the history that we live in the present department. And so,
sort of the advent of the full-time job.
Yeah.
So,
100, 150 years maybe.
Could I turn the question on you and ask what do you foresee?
I really didn't mean to insert myself in the dialogue just to prompt your thoughts. It seems to me, I hope for the day when this is dark history that kids have to read about in middle school history books, when parents have to leave their families to go to an office and go to work. And do you have any hope that this is coming in the future for your children or your grandchildren?
I find myself hoping for that day a lot as well, because, like I said, I think it's tragic for kids and for their fathers, especially when the father becomes the breadwinner solely for the family, to have to miss out on those formative years together. I'm not qualified to answer a question about what's going to happen in the future as far as that goes, but I think it stinks.
Above your pay grade.
Above what?
It's above your pay grade, that question.
Yeah. there was something else I was going to say, but I don't recall what it was. It's never been ideal, though. You know, when you're talking about historically, you have children earning a living for their families in the recent past as well, so...
But you could argue...
We're waiting for the idea.
But you could argue that that's an artifact of the same sort of pathological cultural development of specialization and industrialization. And if you go back before the Industrial Revolution, children...
You're talking about children gathering and farming and all of those things, working with their families, but they're also, you know, living to the age of 40, maybe, because of all of the hard work. So...
Okay, I'll try. I'm one of the bloggers up here, and I do make a pretty good living blogging. And my husband and I would like to be able to live off of my blog solely. I only blog in the evenings after my child has gone to bed, so my kind of hope is that he has had the secret hero lifestyle that he doesn't know about. I don't want him to know about it, I think. Now, anyway, that is what we hope to attain. My husband has a great job with a wonderful company, but he travels. He's gone a lot. And I have thought many times, is this healthy to have a husband who's gone that much? However, when he's home, and that creates a problem because my baby likes him better than me. And I think, you know, I'm supposed to be the mom. So then I start to wonder, is that balance good? Is it good to have dad home all the time and mom home all the time? And because I start to feel like my job really isn't that important. I start to feel kind of like, you know, who's the boss here? Who's in charge here? And so that has presented a problem, but I would hope that we could evolve. And I think one of our greatest hopes is to be able to evolve to the point where he can be at home and we can garden and do the things like I was just talking about, cut coupons and really create a lifestyle where our children can be homeschooled, can be taught from home. That's kind of our hope and dreams of the future. And I don't know, we'll see if it comes to pass. I mean, I could lose all of my ad sponsorship tomorrow. I don't know, but that's kind of what we are praying and hoping for.
I was going to say, it's always caught my attention in the account in Moses where it talks about Adam going out and tilling the earth, that Eve goes with him, that they work side by side, it says that in Moses chapter 5, verse 1, I believe. And so I've always been kind of think that maybe that division of labor wasn't always as strict as it is now, or maybe that was just before children, I don't know. And maybe we'll move back to that as more people are able to telecommute. But it's sort of my ideal, too, I guess, that we could work where our children can see us and see what we're doing all day. Not just playing all day, but they see that we're what we're engaged in doing. But I think it's complicated. I mean, even on the computer, if you telecommute, I'm not sure that they quite understand what you're doing there. But they're saved anyway.
The only thing I would add is I just would like to speak up for communities, though. As much as we would like to, as much as the importance of our nuclear families are, I wouldn't want to totally, go into a hole and we all live in our little house and we don't get out there and share with the world. I think that would be something that was sad if that were lost.
Well, I appreciated, Linda, your collection of books, and I was given it about the age of 15, Fascinating Womanhood. Stay charming while you're angry. And I also had a woman dressed as a bride come to my class.
Was it Young Women?
Yeah. And the message was, you know, if you play your cards right, you too could be a bride. And I'm just curious about whether my early education in my Mormon culture sent me very far away from that model. I mean, I was very determined that was not going to be my story. And I have come around and I'm the mother of two small children and stay at home with them, and that is a joy. But I'm curious about whether you all, as you raise your children, feel like you need to counter that. And I know things have changed. I'm hoping they've changed since rural Idaho in the early 80s.
I see, counter that with our children, like teach them something.
Well, I'm wondering if you ever feel like you need to amend that. At the same time that you are joyously engaged in staying at home with them, because it is a rich experience, if you feel like you need to amend the or counter the kinds of messages that they get about there being, especially with young daughters, about there being a pretty strict set of steps for them. So
I feel that way all the time. I feel like when my kids come home, we need to deconstruct whatever it was that they learned in church. A lot of people probably feel that way, especially with the girls, yeah. I'm so grateful to the men and women that teach my kids at church and that teach them at school. It took me a long time to realize about being a stay-at-home mom that it's really unhealthy to try to be everything to your children. It's unhealthy for them and unhealthy for me. And but that's a difficult place to be, to try and mediate those messages that they're getting. And unfortunately, I feel like they haven't changed very much since I was young. I think the biggest influence for me in developing my sort of independent mindset was my own mother. It was not the things that I was being told, because I could see that my household was not reflecting some of the things that I was being taught, and I loved the way that I was raised, so I was lucky, I guess.
I feel like a little bit of a post-feminist in this, because my experience was my mother was not happy when I got married. She was not happy when I had kids. That was not the path that she wanted for me. She wanted me to be a more aggressive career person that she came to later in life. And so I guess I've come back a little bit defensive, maybe like Camilla's last year, for the stay-at-home mom or the person who chooses that. I just think we ought to be able to respect wherever they want to spend their energies. I do hope, I mean, we do try to mediate the messages that they have options, that this, you're not groomed for a certain path, but if they choose that path, that should be just as okay.
I have been unsure with my daughters how to approach that topic. Certainly when I was a young women's leader, I made it a point to make most of the activities based on career options, and we went to hospitals and met with physicians, and I was, you know, that was not coming out of the manual. That was my addition to it, my surreptitious addition to it. I had a really inauthentic moment during that rant period that I described to you, where I had the apron was new, and I turned to my not my special needs daughter, but the next oldest daughter, and said, "Aubrey, be a doctor. Do you want to wear one of these one day?" And she said, no. So, I don't want to be, I don't want my rant, and I've described to you that was a rant, and it was inauthentic, because truly what does move, touch, and inspire me is to be home. That's what I have chosen. I did not choose to become a doctor. And I don't want to live through my children or tell them that they need to be something that I'm not. So I hope that she'll just observe. She'll see what's wonderful about what I do. And I hope she'll observe what her father does and see what's great about what he does and what's not great about being a physician, and make her own decisions.
I've tried to make a point of supporting women who've made other choices than mine to my kids, on being excited about
her best friend's mom, who's the cardiac surgeon, and being happy for their successes and not, you know, there are times when you could really show, you know, play, well, gee, you've got me now here with you making you dinner and spending time on this, and she doesn't have that. And I really try to stay away from that, and I try to authentically be happy. That's the best example, is that if you're happy in what you're doing, then happiness is the goal, not the particular way that you're doing it.
I was a stay-at-home wife for the first about 8 or 9 months of our marriage, and I went from a job that I'd had for 10 plus years to moving. The only thing I had left from my old life was my cat and my last name, and it was a really rough transition for me. And during one tearful explanation to my husband of what it was like to shift in this way, I said, you know, I wore my mother's 1956 wedding dress. I didn't want to wear her life. And it was only then that he started to understand how difficult it was for me to go from the person I'd been to this person who stayed home. And I couldn't tell people what I did, because I didn't do anything. I was a distant stepmother for, you know, the kids would visit and that, you know, so it was pretty light duty. And when people would ask me about, you know, my life or, you know, things like that, you know, I struggled with what to tell them, because it felt like I didn't have anything anymore. And so I wanted to emphasize what Erica said about, you know, keeping some identity with you through these transitions and through the different places that we find ourselves in our lives. And I also wanted to ask, how can we be more sensitive to each other? Because I would just dissolve in tears when people would ask me, oh, so what do you do? And I, you know, and it was such a raw feeling for me to feel like I went from this really full life to being a housewife in South Texas. And yeah, so I just wanted to get a sense of where have people been insensitive about the choices you've made, and where can we do better? Any takers?
Oh yeah, I don't want to do all the talking, but I described again that period where I felt very sensitive to any woman's choice that was contrary to how I was feeling. I invalidated their happiness in being stay-at-home moms and felt that they were doomed and didn't see it. And that really disappeared for me. And so I don't feel, from a personal point of view, someone asking me what I do, I am now empowered by the choice that I've made, and so I don't feel sensitive about it. So I don't know if you can. So someone that's feeling disempowered by their choice, I don't know if it's someone outside of that can compensate for that. I mean, if certainly you could be sensitive that they're feeling that way, and you know, these damaging comments, I just dismiss them, really. That what I see is the ultimate power, influence is not powerful. That's immaterial to me. So I guess what I'm saying is that it starts with your own regard for your own choice, and that you have power over that. Do you have other comments about how we can be sensitive to one another?
Yeah, I love that. I love that, what you just said, because it all depended on me when I was a stay-at-home wife, and I'm happy to be another. It all depended on how I answered the question, what do you do? And I would make things up. Sometimes I'd say that I'm the manager of my husband's career, because I'm so embarrassed, you know. But which is always true, I guess. But it was about coming to a place where I was just so happy where I was that I couldn't help but share that with other people. And I believe that charity, the whole point of charity, or the whole, what we do when we say we seek for charity, is just to wish somebody well. And I've noticed that that's what the other women on this panel are saying, that the best thing that we can do for other women is just to wish them well. Their choices, like if they're working for the second Mercedes, just wish them well, you know? Enjoy that ride. Sunday drives are probably so much better, and I don't know, maybe car seats are really awesome too, but that's what I think. I think in northern Utah County where I live, I guess it depends on your environment, how you feel sensitized to these kinds of issues, because the women that live around me, if they have families at home and they do work, they always feel compelled to have to explain it to me and apologize in some way for why they dared to have a career and they have children who I guess they're assuming I feel need them to be at home. And I think that's really unfortunate because it is a moral decision, but it's a moral decision in the context of your own life and your family, and it's very personal. And so imposing whatever kind of morality I may impose on whatever anyone else's life choices is just wrong. And it's uncomfortable. And I do find that there's a disconnect. There seems to be kind of a mommy club that develops. Because I think that stay-at-home moms need some kind of validation. We need other people to recognize our experience. And it's exclusive and it's unfortunate. And I don't know how to bridge that gap. I think it's very hard for women who work in my environment.
Can I say one? You're just about through.
Yeah.
Can I just?
We have 5 minutes.
My hair gives me the opportunity.
This is my mom.
Okay. I'm going to I just want to say two things. You are not where you are. You are so much more than where you are. If you are in your home, you are so much more. Of course you're affected by it. Of course the children develop you. But let's not define ourselves by being in the workforce or being at home. We're all so much more than that. And also, I don't like you saying women that work. Raising a family and being home is the hardest job there is. So it's workforce, okay? Anyway, but I want to thank you. It's wonderful for me, after my many years of experience in the feminist movement in the Mormon Church, to hear you, because I think we've made great progress. We still struggle with the same things, but you're doing what you want to do. Remember that. That's the important thing. So, hooray for you.
I am going to join Mark as a future stay-at-home dad.
All right.
This reminds me of what my wife and I went through. It was interesting. We were very much in the mainstream of the Mormon story. I went on my mission. I came home. We got married within about 3 months. We had known each other in high school. And then we got jobs, we had kids, and we bought a house. And we were so deeply in debt and so out of our element. And we realized that things were not going well. And we had to physically remove ourselves to the furthest corner of Alaska to be able to remake our story. And it turned out that we became co-parents. But removing ourselves from that was a huge act of transgression, it felt like, to me. And was very difficult. Now, it seems to me that the people who are hard on stay-at-home mothers are the people who feel like this person has been inside the story and has just been moved along by it and has never taken the time to actually own that story or deliberately choose it. So the way that you people are different is that you chose what you did. But you're in a community of people who might or might not be those people who have stayed in the story and never actually chosen it. But I'm curious if those people actually exist. Do you look around yourself in your community and find women who have just stayed inside the story and never actually chosen it volitionally?
I think most of humanity has not chosen what they're doing. I really think it is the exception to the rule to live an examined life. And if being a stay-at-home mother is something that runs against the grain of our culture, has for a little while, and helps us, forces us to examine our choices, hooray. It's not the only way to examine your life, but it's something that seems to come with the territory.
I just want to agree with that. That was my comment, too. I think that is the inherent nature of a human being to want to be a victim and to not own their choices. And there's great empowerment that comes when you do. And we have time for one more minute of questions, or we can wrap from here. Does anyone else want to add anything?
Another round of applause.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate Stetson for giving us this voice today. Thank you.